You can shop from anywhere doing pretty much anything. You might shop while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast. And however you shop, we all know and love the thrill of the hunt. But do you also know how to get the thrill of the best deals? Because Rakuten shoppers do. With Rakuten, they get the deals they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Sephora, Nike, and even Expedia if you're looking to get some travel in. And getting cash back doesn't mean you have to miss out on sales because those can just be stacked right on top. It's easy to use and based on a simple idea. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back through PayPal or check. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
Hey there. Ever wonder what happens to all those amazing screenplays that never make it to the big screen? Well, wonder no more. Welcome to Table Read Podcast, where we bring those undiscovered gems to life. Picture this, talented actors giving incredible performances with the occasional laugh or blooper thrown in, produced by award-winning pros. From drama to comedy, TV pilots to feature films, there's something for everyone. And guess what? We release new episodes every week, so don't forget to hit that subscribe button. Table Read Podcast, where great stories finally get their chance to shine.
This podcast is being brought to you by Voyage AC.
Hey, honey, I'm going by the store. Do you need anything?
Almond butter, stuff for salad, maybe some of those chips you like?
No, I mean, I'm going by Voyage AC.
Oh, Voyage AC. Well, then let's see. Bedtime spray, vitamin C cream, a couple of those candles you got me from last time, the ones that smelled so good.
Oh, the Eau de Tabac. Yes. We definitely need more of those in our house. Voyage AC is your destination for all these amazing fragrances and gifts. You'll want to go online right now and check out their amazing gifts like beautiful votive candles, incredible fragrances, and gorgeous face and body products. And if you're in Los Angeles or visiting here, check out their store in Studio City. So, hun, how can our listeners find Voyage AC?
Yep, you can find everything on their website at www.voyageac.com. That's VoyageTcie.
And as you know, Melanie is willing to give my friends and family discount to all our listeners right now. That's 10% off everything you buy.
All you need to do is enter the code THE ONLY ONE at checkout.
That's right. All you have to do is enter the code THE ONLY ONE when you make your purchase. Voyage AC is an olfactory journey of candles, perfume, and organic beauty products.
I'm Mary Beth O'Connor, and I'm the only one who went from junkie to judge. When I found meth, the intensity of the high just really took me outside of myself. Dan and I just went off the cliff. And the next 10 years were just misery, right? As I say, I worked my way down the corporate ladder. So I graduate with a Berkeley degree and actually good grades. And my first job is sort of an entry-level position that could have promotional opportunities. But because, you know, I'm using, I can't hold on to any of the jobs.
I'm probably one of the few people I know who still looks forward to my Sunday newspaper. Not a digital copy that I read on my phone, but the real finger-staining, loud crinkling, section-by-section newspaper. The Sunday paper for me is a treat to be enjoyed while lounging in bed and sipping hot lemon water. So one day when we were going through all of the Only One stories that are being submitted to us, thank you for those, by the way. We love reading them. It was Scott's idea to record and release a few of them occasionally, but always on Sundays, and call them our Sunday edition. And because they're only 30 minutes long, our hope is that you can enjoy them while sipping your morning beverage, going for a walk, or even just enjoying a lazy Sunday at home. Please enjoy today's Sunday edition, and be sure to listen every Tuesday when we drop another brand new episode of The Only One in the Room. Mary Beth O'Connor. Hi, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Really good. So glad to have you on the show. And we're going to talk to you about being a judge, which is really cool. But here's my question for you before we start. Because you're a judge in real life, if you had to be a judge on either The Voice or The Great British Bake Off, which would you choose?
Okay. Just for clarity, I'm actually a retired judge.
Right, right. But, yes.
I would have to say with the voice, mostly because I do not cook or much less bake.
Okay.
We actually redid our kitchen and my husband asked me if we had to buy an oven or we could just get the door and put it up. So
you really don't bake. That's hilarious. What do you do? Do you like order out all the time?
No, you know, we were on different schedules for work, and so we weren't home a lot together in
okay.
the evening,
yeah.
so we just didn't cook very much for most of
got
our
it,
relationship.
Got it. And do you watch The Voice?
No.
No. <You're> just, okay.
But
I don't.
You, but yeah. you eat cake. You eat baked goods.
I do. But it's okay. always seemed funny to me that these baking shows, you know, they're describing it, right? It's not as if you can taste it, so that's
right.
an interesting aspect to
that's
it.
That's true. That's mm-hmm. true. Yeah, it's just very, really popular, the Great British Bake Off. Like people, especially during the pandemic, people went crazy over
that
show.
Yeah, we were baking like crazy, weren't we?
Well, you were.
Scotty, I was a little bit.
You were.
I don't even like to bake. I like to cook, but I don't like to bake.
All right. Thank you so much for that. I am Laura Cathcart-Robbins, and this is the Only One in the Room special Sunday edition. But I am never the only one in this room because, as usual, my boyfriend, producer, and co-host, Scott Slaughter, who I call Hun, is here as well.
Hi, honey.
Hey, honey. So today, like I said, we have Mary Beth O'Connor. I'm going to tell you a little bit about her, okay? She is a Berkeley Law graduate, a retired federal judge, board member and secretary for She Recovers Foundation, and is a board member of Life Ring Secular Recovery. Mm. Mm-hmm. Mary Beth started using methamphetamine in high school, was an addict for 16 years. She was ordered to surrender to a higher power on her first day of rehab, even though she didn't believe in God. Being an atheist in a 12-step world forced her to forge her own path out of addiction. I like that sentence, right? Mm-hmm. Forge her own path. She believes in the saga of how she transitioned from junkie to judge can provide hope and guidance in this time of increasing secularity. And again, with the streets flooded with meth, mm-hmm. right? Because it's such a problem. It's a huge problem, especially here, I think, in Los Angeles where we are.
Yeah, and post-pandemically.
Post-pandemically.
I think, we haven't even seen.
Is that a new phrase?
It
post-pandemically?
Might be.
We should start using that.
Uh-huh. I think we haven't even seen the results of that life.
Yeah.
That year and a plus. Of,
right, because people have been like, can hide out.
Yeah.
And so, Mary Beth, tell me, how did you find our show?
I was referred to it by She Recovers. Someone pointed me to some of your episodes.
Oh, good.
I watched it. Yes. I listened. Yes.
Okay, good. Yeah, because you sent in a submission to us, which we always appreciate. We read all our submissions. But yours was a real standout for both Scott and I. We both turned to each other and like, are you looking at this? Mm-hmm. This is somebody we really need to have on the show. So first, I'm going to ask you how you identify.
She and her.
So I want to ask you about a couple of things, but I'll start with one of the things that you and I talked about when we talked on the phone, which was you started drinking at age 12. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. And then there's some other things that have come up and you talk about them pretty openly. You're recovering not just from drugs and alcohol, but from child abuse and abuse, right?
That's right. I mean, as I say, the short version is childhood abuse leads to childhood addiction. And that's pretty much how it started with me.
Right. I don't want you to get too descriptive of it, but can you just tell us the kind of abuse that you're talking about?
There was both verbal, physical, sexual, emotional. Mm. There was also neglect, which is actually a factor. It took me a while to really see that was impactful as well.
Yeah.
So it was a large combination. And it wasn't all in the home. I had some other assaults in college. So there was a lot of trauma.
Yeah, I'm so sorry to hear that. You and I actually emailed back and forth about some other trauma that was rape, right?
Yes, yes.
Did that happen when you were younger or did it happen once you got to college? Was that the first time was in college?
You know, it's interesting because in my time, consent wasn't as clear of a concept as it is today. And so when I think back to it and I've been working on my memoir and paying some attention,
yeah.
there were a lot of episodes that at the time I didn't categorize as a sexual assault, but now that I would. But as far as the sort of clear cut, no one would argue. Even then, there was a significant rape event when I was 17 and another really bad one when I was 19.
Oh, wow. Hey, I'm so glad. Thank you for talking about consent and that line being blurred. because that's how it was for me as well. Just not giving my consent and not knowing that that wasn't okay for them to then take action or make assumptions about me. Things happened that I didn't give consent to that I never considered to be traumatic because I thought that's just the way that it was. I really appreciate you making that clear because I think for so many people, women in particular, but also men and non-binary people, that line gets blurry and nobody clears it up for them, you know?
And that's why I really have been very glad to see the more current discussions around that. I think it's a conversation that's been missing and that is going to add a lot of value and validation to women's experiences. Because even if we didn't categorize it as a sexual assault, I don't think we were happy about these things, right? We did have a sense that someone was crossing a line or doing something that wasn't in our best interest. I just don't know that we had the words to talk about it or felt justified to complain, perhaps.
Yeah. I mean, it's like that, you know, her lips said no, but her eyes said yes. And then people take that license. So yeah, thank you again for bringing that up. We're going to take just a quick break to tell you about a cool new product that Scott and I discovered. And we'll get back to our guest's amazing Only One story in just a minute.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/realm. As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/realm.
So started drinking at age 12. When did you find methamphetamines?
When I was 16, I found meth.
Okay. And how did you find it?
This is in the 70s. And methamphetamine actually exploded in my area around 1976, 77.
And what was your area then? Where were you?
I lived in South Jersey. And okay. The rumor mill at the time was that the biker gangs had actually figured out how to make meth in labs locally, but it certainly flooded the area at around that time. Mm. It was readily available.
Mm-hmm. So it was popular in your circle? People were...
Well, it depends on how you define my circle. So in school, I was a top student. You know, I got a lot of good grades and I was surrounded by a small group of us that, you know, had all the advanced classes together. It was a South Jersey working class area. So the number of students that were even thinking about college was small. But that group, in that group, no, drug use was not common. But in my outside world, I had a separate set of friends. I drank and then I moved on to pot and pills and acid before I found meth. And so over those years, I developed a lot of drug using relationships. And so in that world, meth became more popular.
Right. What did you like about it?
It made me feel happy. It made me feel energetic and positive. It shoved down the negative feelings, which is really had been my goal all along with all of the drugs. I mean, when I say I drank and I did these others, I abused all those other drugs too, up to the point that I found my favorite.
Right. Yes.
I abused everything. But when I found meth, the intensity of the high just really took me outside of myself. Mm. And the fact that I could stay up, right? So being able to stay up for days, you just sort of get, I got number and number and number. And then when I crashed, when I slept, it was this dark, deep sleep where I wasn't dreaming or having nightmares or tossing and turning. It was oblivion.
Right.
And I liked that.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would get up and, you know, start again.
Right. So why would anybody quit anything like that? Tell me why.
Well, I mean, because that was the fun part, right? That was the beginning, but the fun goes away quickly. I started shooting meth within 6 months of using it.
Mm-hmm.
When I graduated from high school, I was shooting meth. I remember on graduation day, I actually hit a nerve in my hand and my fingers were curled up. And you know how they give you your diploma with one hand and they shake the other?
Yeah.
They shook the hand that was curled and deformed, and I almost screamed in pain on the stage. It was my high school graduation. But after that, I did go to Berkeley and I was able to keep my addiction under somewhat control for 3.5 years, mostly because I didn't use meth.
Right.
But I moved in with a violent boyfriend my senior year and I just turned to my old relief and I, you know, started using meth again and I just went off the cliff all over again.
Mm.
And the next 10 years were just, you know, misery, right? As I say, I worked my way down the corporate ladder.
Right. So tell me what you mean by that. I love that expression, but tell me what you mean.
I graduate with a Berkeley degree and actually good grades. And my first job is sort of an entry level position that could, you know, would have promotional opportunities. But because by then I can't hold on to any of the jobs. And so the next jobs, looking at the resume where I only lasted 9 months at the prior job. And
right.
And so then I take that job and it just kept on going. And at the end, I was doing basically a word processing job.
Right.
Which I also couldn't hold because I couldn't get there on time and I couldn't stay. And
yeah.
I spent a lot of time in the bathroom getting high.
And on paper, you're overqualified, of course, for a word processing job, right?
Well, by that point, when you looked at my work history, it was
clearly stepping down.
If you looked only at my degree, yes, I was overqualified, but clearly something was amiss. So yes.
So then tell me about checking into treatment.
So when I went into treatment, I was 32 years old. So, you know, I had been using for 20 years. I had been using speed basically for 16 years, and I was really destroyed. I was not only did I have employment problems, but my body was literally breaking down. I had a lot of physical problems. I was hopeless. I was depressed. I was debilitated. And my husband was, you know, at the end of his rope and really needed me to get help. And I couldn't even get a resume together to get the next lower level job. Like that's how depleted I was. And so I went into rehab. It was a women's program.
Where was that?
It was in Oakland, which is not, I lived in Silicon Valley and this was in Oakland. So I get there and on the first day, you know, I go into a, it was a, like a step study meeting and they were doing the third step. I turned my will of my life over to a higher power. And so, you know, being the good student that I was, I raised my hand and I said, you know, so what about me? I'm an atheist. I don't believe in God or higher power. They did clarify it didn't have to be God. It could be higher power. But I said, no, I'm an atheist. I don't believe in any type of higher power. And the counselor looked at me and she said, higher power relapse. And I looked at her. I was really kind of stunned. And I said, you just told me it's impossible for me to stay clean. It was a surprise to me to find that I was in effectively a 12-step house. I thought I had gone into a medical treatment center, but it really was a 12-step house. And that was all that they offered. They told me repeatedly that that's all that there was.
They weren't only saying, this is all we offer here. They're saying that's all there is.
That's all there is.
Right.
And they weren't saying that, you know, here's the 12 steps. This is a program that works for some people. That wouldn't have concerned me. It was that this is your only option. Comply or fail, basically.
Right. So what did you do?
I really had to stand back early on. I mean, literally within days and think about what I was going to do because I knew it was impossible. Right. So I tried. At first, I tried. I tried to see if there was a way for me to make it work. And I did that for a few weeks, but there really wasn't an option for me. There's the powerlessness. I wasn't comfortable with that. But the first three steps are all, you know, basically God related or powerlessness related steps. And so I was questioning, could this really be the only way? And what am I going to do? This won't work for me. But at the same time, the experts that went for treatment are telling me this is the only way. And I knew that my thinking was foggy, right? And I knew I could look behind me for 10 years and see many poor decisions. And so it was sort of a fight with myself. Should I trust that I know that this is not a viable option for me? Or is that just being arrogant and rejecting the help of the experts, the people that I am paying. And it was the big dilemma for me very early on, basically from day one. And so I really spent some time thinking about what to do. And I decided that I was just going to try my best to keep my ears and my mind open and listen for concepts that I thought would be useful for me. That right. I would just use those and try to ignore the other parts that I knew I couldn't benefit from.
Right. And so how long did that last?
Forever.
Right. Right. So yeah, fast forward 27 years later, you're still abstinent, right?
Yes, I have 27 years. Yes, I do. And now I wasn't absent from that moment. I will say I did use twice in rehab and once when I got home, but my clean date is January of 94.
Wait, you used in rehab?
I did use twice, but that was twice in 5 months. Like that was really good. I thought that was.
Did you do it while you were there in the house?
I did. I did use twice when I was there. Yeah. But I didn't get caught. And then I went home and I used about 10 days later. And then that ended up being the last time.
Okay. For people who don't know, that's super typical.
Yes.
It's not like, oh, she used in rehab. It happens all the time. It's actually surprising when it doesn't happen. I think statistically it's surprising when it doesn't happen. So then tell me about deciding that you were going to seek out a different type of recovery than what you were finding in 12-step rooms.
Well, so at first, you know, I tried to talk to them about my concerns. And for example, I would raise questions about the program and they would tell me things like, you know, my best thinking got me there. And I do remember saying, you know, I promise it wasn't my best thinking. And I would ask them, you know, why, if this is a disease, the way you're teaching me, would the solution be spiritual? And they just told me I was fighting the program. They actually did point me to the agnostic chapter of the big book. I think in an honest effort to try to find a way for me to fit in. And I was excited. I was thought, you know, well, why didn't you tell me this the first day? So I ran to my room and I read that chapter, but it's really just sort of a weak argument about not being an agnostic. And it's still requires that you have a higher power. So, so I did everything that I could that they said. I mean, I tried to take the parts that were useful, like they told me, you know, and I agreed, I was an addict, no drugs, no alcohol, right? I tried to take what I could from all the classes. They would teach us things about triggers, and they recommended developing clean and sober relationships and using group support. And there are parts of the things I found at 12-step meetings that I did find useful. I liked one day at a time because I could handle that while not having any confidence, you know, in my ability to maintain long-term sobriety. I know a lot of people don't like the drug alongs, but for me in the beginning, they were valuable because I was looking at people who looked healthy and their lives were getting back under control. And yet when they told their story, they had been as deep in their addiction as I was. They had destroyed their life the same way that I did. And so that started to give me some hope that I could recover. You know, if they could do it, maybe I could too. And so I did try to pull what I could out. I thought a lot about the powerlessness idea. I wasn't comfortable with that either. I didn't want to turn my will and my life over to anything, but I did try to think about sort of what's underneath the concepts. Is there anything at the core, a nugget that I can use? And so what I decided was that I was powerless to moderate, right?
Like, right.
I cannot moderate. I need to accept that.
I
thought about step three, you know, the turn your will in your life over, and I tried to use it as a lesson in limited control. For example, if I was looking for a job, I could look in the want ads. Oh, yeah, the want ads, the paper in those days. You know, submit a resume.
Right. You're taking us back.
I'm taking it back. The want ads in the newspaper, hard copy newspaper.
Right.
My efforts could increase my odds of success, but I really couldn't control the outcome. So I did things like that. I tried to hear what is here that I might be able to use.
Yeah, I really like that. And I don't even know if we talked about this, but you might know it from listening to the podcast, but both Scott and I are in 12-step recovery, but I'm also someone who doesn't believe in a deity. So I have done some gymnastics with some of our steps in order to make them work. And that's, I like that idea, that concept for step three a lot. So thank you for that. I want to take us now to you becoming an attorney and then becoming a judge.
So when I had 6 years clean, I went to law school, which was, you know, like 16 years after I had graduated college. I went to law school and I went to Berkeley again. Immediately after law school, I went to work in a law firm in Silicon Valley. And that was really a high number of hours job. You know, it was working 50, 60, 70 hours a week every week. There was really sort of, as I used to say, no light at the end of that tunnel. And so again, I stood back and tried to figure out, well, what do I want in my life? What's the right place for me? And so I decided to leave that job and go work for the federal government as an attorney, because I thought it would be a better work-life balance for me. It would give me time to do something other than work, basically. And so I worked for the government as an attorney. I did a lot of class action work. I oversaw the litigation in San Francisco for several years. And then I applied to become an administrative law judge, which is a testing process. So they open it up and I think 5,500 people applied the year that I did. They only open it up every couple of years. And you go through these levels of testing and they cut. And I made it all the way through to the end. And I was in the first group hired and I became an administrative law judge for the Social Security Agency.
How
here
cool.
In the Bay Area.
That's pretty amazing. And so when was that?
I was appointed in 2014 and I took early retirement at the beginning of 2020.
What was the pressure like in that position?
It was a different type of pressure than being an attorney because you're making a decision about people's lives, right? And so there's the weight of that. When you're an attorney, you feel the weight of making the best case and the best outcome for your client. So that has one type of pressure. But I was making decisions about people who were applying for Social Security benefits or who had other issues with matters related to Social Security benefits. And for a lot of these people, you know, they have medical issues. They believe that they're entitled to benefits. A lot of people have financial problems. Also, the process is very slow. They've been waiting usually 2 years or longer to even get in front of me. You know, they would testify before me, and it was a challenge to be able to make the decision that I needed to make, to follow the rules and the law to the best of my ability, which I always did, but also knowing all the time that I was making a critical decision in that person's life. And that does weigh on you. I wanted to do my best to come to the right conclusion, because my decision was going to have a great impact on the person sitting before me.
Well, and that's going to lead me back to, because I want you to tell me what kept you centered and what kept you balanced. And I know that you are involved in two different recovery organizations, right? I know there are a lot of atheists who walk into 12-step recovery rooms where they walk right back out and they never come back because they hear God, and that you are involved with She Recovers and Life Ring Secular Recovery. So can you talk about those two organizations a little bit?
When I got clean and sober in 94, LifeRing was SOS, Psycho Organization for Sobriety. LifeRing's sort of it was an offshoot, and it has been the surviving entity. And so LifeRing believes in a personal recovery plan, that the individual is responsible for their own recovery, that their success is based on their motivation and their own efforts, that you're not powerless and actually it's your job to fight. On the other hand, LifeRing also does not mandate any one particular program. And a lot of LifeRing members go to other programs at the same time. There are people in LifeRing that also do 12 steps. And there are certainly people that do Women for Sobriety or SMART, and they do LifeRing. So LifeRing believes that it's your sort of responsibility to listen, to read, to attend, to gather ideas and information so that you can determine what's the best approach for you. It's called a personal recovery plan. And then the group's job is to really assist you in your sobriety, in helping your sober self, is the terminology, to help you build a stronger sober self. So in a LifeRing meeting, there's discussion, there's crosstalk. Members talk to each other directly as support. In a LifeRing meeting, someone might come and, you know, a newcomer, say, is going to a work event for the first time with alcohol. And they will ask, how did other people here handle that? And there'll be a discussion about techniques and tricks, you know, about what you can do. But it's still your job to listen to the ideas, but to decide which of those ideas might be of value to you, which ones might work for you. It's not that they're telling you what to do. They're offering suggestions so that you can filter them and figure out what's going to be part of your plan.
And that's a really good example too, because everyone who puts down substances comes up against that at some point, where I'm going to be in a social situation without alcohol or drugs, if it's that kind of social situation, and I don't know how to do or how I'm going to navigate it.
That's true. But it's also that there's also unique factors going into the situation, right? I mean, what your work environment is like, for example, if it's a work event, how alcohol focused that work environment is, how much you used to drink at the work environment, whether anyone's likely to notice, how big a deal it would be if you said you were in recovery. All of those are sort of individualized factors. And so what worked for me might not be the right solution for you. I'm letting you know what did work for me for your benefit, for you to consider, because I want to help you do everything I can to help you in your recovery as well.
Yeah. And so what about She Recovers?
She Recovers is broader than just substance use disorder. She Recovers, sort of the mantra is, we're all recovering from something. I don't know the exact ratio, but most of the women, a large percentage of the women that participate in She Recovers do have substance use disorders, but they also have often other disorders as well, like me, right? I have substance use disorder. I have a child abuse history, a rape history. I have other traumas. Many of the women have mental health challenges. People have grief issues. They might have eating disorder. So everyone is together. And part of that is because I think we all know in our recovery, those issues often do overlap. Many people with substance use disorder have other struggles as well. And so when She Recovers, everyone's really, you know, together in that way. And they give each other the mutual support. And She Recovers, they do, well, outside of COVID, but they have retreats. They do conferences. They have an active Facebook page. They have presentations like I presented about Life Ring for She Recovers. There's a lot of different aspects of She Recovers to provide that support to the women. It's a very robust community that the women in it really love it. They feel very motivated to participate and to help each other.
And as someone who's not a member of She Recovers, I've always felt very supported by the members of She Recovers. And, you know, do whatever I can to support them as well. Just, I love women's organizations that are just about supporting people in their endeavors. And I am definitely of the belief that almost everybody I know should be in recovery from something. I'm serious. And I'm not saying it like I want to drag everybody down.
No.
I think the world would be a much better place if people looked at their own stuff and took action to move forward on it and release things that they were holding on to that they don't need to anymore. I think that's great. I think that people coming together in that common goal of sharing their recovery is beautiful. So, gosh, thank you for all that. We're actually at time, so I'm going to ask you where people can find you.
You can find me at junkietojudge.com. That's my website, and you can contact me through that. That's really the easiest way.
Beautiful. And yeah, and on your site, you have a couple of different interviews with you that people can watch, and they can contact you that way as well?
Yes, there's contact information there, yes.
Wonderful. Well, Mary Beth O'Connor, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much, Mary Beth. That was awesome.
Thank you. I really appreciate being here.
Thank you for listening to The Only One in the Room. Please join us each Tuesday and Sunday for an incredible brand new Only One interview. And every Friday for On My Nightstand, where I'll be reading something that I love. If you have an Only One story you'd like to share or a piece of writing you'd like to submit, please send it to theonlyonepod@gmail.com. From all of us at The Only One in the Room, we wish you dopeness, health, and prosperity.
Have you ever watched a futuristic sci-fi movie and wondered, but wait, could any of this really happen? And will I live long enough to see it? That's what our show Hypothetical is about. I'm Carrie Bechet, and on this podcast, we ask what-if questions about the future. Like, what if we could read minds? What if the world's digital data was erased all at once? What would happen if the Yellowstone supervolcano erupted? Then we explore that question two ways, through speculative science fiction and through dialogue with brilliant scientists. The result is a genre-bending narrative that's interwoven with real facts provided by literal geniuses. And spoiler alert, a lot of the science fiction out there, it's not nearly as far-fetched as you might think. Come time travel with me into the future on Hypothetical. New episodes on Tuesdays, available on all your favorite podcast apps. Just search Hypothetical. That's HYPERTHETICAL.